Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Michael Wangpa. I'm joined by an important guest, a New Yorker based in Nairobi, Dr. Ashley Jackson, to discuss Western intervention in Africa. Dr. Jackson is the co-founder of the Center for Armed Groups, an organization that supports research and engagement with armed groups. Ashley has a long-standing career spanning over two decades with vast experience advising various UN agencies, NGOs, and governments on humanitarian issues and conflict mediation. So Ashley has also researched, written, and advised on engagement in several countries, including Somalia, Syria, Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and many other places. Ashley currently works and research on negotiating with armed groups, especially focusing on Afghanistan and the Taliban government. And she's the author of the book Negotiating Survival, Civilian Insurgent Relations in Afghanistan, which was published in 2021. She has also advised several governments, UK Parliament, the US Department on Afghanistan policy. Ashley, that's quite an impressive resume you've got there. We're so lucky and happy to have you as a guest today. You're welcome.
Well, thank you. And thank you for making me sound so incredibly impressive. We'll try and live up to that.
Okay, brilliant. Let me start off from in the last 20 years and a few years now, I think coming up to 25 years, from 9/11 changed the dynamics of you know, global intervention or how we view stuff. So it ushered in a new era of intervention, you know, based on that global war on terror mantra. So we saw interventions in places like Iraq and in Afghanistan, where you're an expert. But 20 years plus after that, it is not clear if that has created more security or created more greater stability or even created more insecurity. What is your general view on this, and how does that manifest in Africa?
Well, I think it's a really interesting moment to ask this question, right? Because it seems like this era of like post 9/11 interventions, counterterrorism, stabilization, peacekeeping, even where there was really no peace to keep in Afghanistan, in Mali, elsewhere, it feels like it's an era that's kind of coming to a close. You know, you had the Taliban take over Afghanistan, you've had the UN now kind of leaving Mali and so on. And these kinds of forms of interventions that really haven't worked, and I would argue it's hard to say that they've made things more insecure, but they've definitely, you've seen the presence in Mali, for example, and in Somalia of these forces lead to more insecurity, right? I mean, it hasn't correlated with stability, we can say that for sure. It's kind of coming to to a close in a weird way, because they're being kicked out or they're leaving in the case of Afghanistan. You still have missions, of course, there's Somalia. But AMISOM is supposed to be drawing down. I think that's been delayed already. We'll see if that actually happens on schedule or anything close. So it's like, it's a strange moment where we don't know what comes next. But this like stabilization, counterterrorism paradigm should be kind of dead. Yet, you know, it's still kind of the only thing that Western countries have is this mode of intervention in conflict countries. So it's been a strange two and a half decades of interventions, right, in these places.
Yeah, I do agree with you. What you mentioned something very, very important. You said, in these places, you see peacekeeping where there's no peace.
Yeah.
Well, can you expatiate on what you mean by that? Where you have peacekeeping missions where, you know, there's no peace. What do you mean by that when you say that?
Well, there's no political settlement that's actually durable or viable. I mean, you look at Mali and how many casualties the UN mission took. You look at AMISOM in Somalia, which is in a role of active combat. You can look at DRC. The list goes on. But it's this strange model that's been applied in different places, in different ways, right? But it's this really muscular military response to what are fundamentally political problems, right? You know, the emergence of jihadist groups or instability and violence, it has a political, economic, social cause. And it's not going to be solved by sending more troops or doing like quick impact projects. Yet that's kind of, that is the de facto response, or has been for the past 20 years. So it's misdiagnosing the problem by sending military forces that have become kind of more muscular, more interventionist, if we look at places like Congo. And not really addressing the political drivers of the insecurity, but taking this really like counterterrorism, hunt them down, drone strikes, using force over actually addressing the drivers.
Yeah, it's quite significant that you said that. We had another guest a couple of weeks ago, Professor Shedrick Conin, and where we looked at. We looked at the UN interventions or UN missions, peacekeeping in other places. And he drew a comparison between interventions in the post 9/11 period and interventions in the past, in the 90s, where they looked more at political settlement, just like you rightly mentioned. They look at root causes and political. It was more diplomatic approach, rather than what we've seen now, you know, the stabilization missions and stuff like that. But if we look at so if I look at, for instance, we've seen in the Sahel, we've seen like in Niger, in Mali, we've seen a resurgence of military coup in these places. How much of that Western or for instance, now we can say French intervention approach, it's fueling that rise?
Yeah,
because we've also seen some anti-French sentiments, or you know, anti-Western, you know, sentiments. How much of that intervention has fueled these sentiments over the years?
It's a really good question, but of course, like what you have in the Sahel is this colonial history, and this. I mean, how could it not fuel that, right? How could it not, at some point, fuel a kind of backlash to? Because these things, they look very much like invasions, right? They're undemocratic. They empower, you know, as much as these invasions were, not invasions, these interventions were meant to create stability, reinforce democracy, often they fueled corruption. They masked the weaknesses of national military forces instead of strengthening them and really making them effective and responsive to what people wanted in these places. And because these interventions yielded the opposite of what they claimed to want, I mean, if you were an average person in Mali, you'd be very suspicious. You know, why are you really here if all you're doing is creating more violence? And I think that's the question that a lot of people in these countries then ask themselves, like, what is this good for, right? I mean, we might as well kick you out and find another sponsor who can help us. Or, you know, and I think these interventions have also not really empowered democratic forces, right? They haven't really empowered civil society, or, you know, it's the men with the guns who get the attention, the money, and the funding, and who benefit from the economic rents. And so, contrary to what the French or what others have said that they want, the design of their interventions has had these like profoundly counterproductive, anti-democratic impacts. And so it's no surprise, right, that you then have this huge backlash.
Amazing. So I was looking. So let's put it this way. You've written also in the past on British Empire and British. You know, do you think there's a difference? Because if I look at, for instance, if you look at in Niger, for instance, French has been kicked out, but not the US. The US troops are still in Niger. What is this dynamic?
One might argue that the US are less imposing and they have more money. I think obviously there's a specific dynamic with the French, where they were really there playing a lead role, playing a very strong role, really, and reasserting their sphere of influence in Africa, right? That's what it was about for them. For the US, speaking as an American, we don't, like, the US doesn't have that colonial legacy. It has a different legacy of asserting its influence, right? But that, which comes with its own baggage, right? It's not better or worse. It's just, I think, different. And the use of special forces and these kinds of things flies under the radar, right? Whereas most French people are keenly aware, I assume, of their country's engagement in the Sahel, most Americans, if you told them that there were forces in the Sahel, they'd be surprised, right? They don't really, American media doesn't talk about the extent of which US interventionism, especially in Africa, it is still really a part of the US military and foreign policy strategy. It just doesn't, it's not even on their radar, which I think is also an interesting aspect of some of this.
Yeah, I think the death of the four special during the Obama period, it did bring spotlight. You know, a lot of Americans were surprised that they even had, you know, special troops in Niger at the time, you know, when they lost that four. Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you there. But you mentioned something about democracy, and there's been this argument, and I think again we have to take it back to the colonial times when you've mentioned, like, you know, people have argued that the colonial administration wasn't democratic. It wasn't a democratic. So then again, we look at it and say, does the West, is the West really, really serious? Are they really concerned about, you know, democracy in these places, like Ivrala said? Because, you know, it looks like what we're seeing is the opposite of that. Is stabilization same thing as promoting democratic values? And I'm writing a book at the moment that looks at democracy, looking at liberal democracy, and looking at how that also, we can't divorce that from the militarization in these places. How do you see it? Do you think the kind of democracy that is being practiced, or the Western, you know, because we can excuse the Americans as well. We look at after the post-Cold War, Americans were the hegemon, and America, you know, had this, you know, exploitation of democracy and liberal democracy. So how has that worked over time? How has that created, you know, the militarization that we're currently experiencing in these places?
Yeah, I think it's complex, right? Democracy at home is different than the democracy a country expects or imposes, or how it uses democracy as a discourse or as a set of tools to intervene, right? And we have to kind of be very clear about that. If you were to really deal with these countries on their own terms, democracy or some sort of participatory governance would look really different than elections every 4 years, or a parliament, or all of the things that the West expects. Women's rights would look in a lot of these places different. there would be a concept of human rights and women's rights. It just would be different. And I think this imposition of our expectations, which, by the way, we don't uphold terribly well in our countries, if I think about the US, right? If we talk about human rights in the US right now, or women's rights, right? Yeah. It's in a dire state and it's quickly going backwards. And I think, so to return to that question, you know, the rhetoric of democracy begins, I think, to look to a lot of people, it certainly looked this way to Afghans and to Somalis, as another means of imposing control. And you have elections treated as this really strange kind of benchmark of progress, like we have to have these elections. Whole kind of donor cycles revolve around elections and like just having the elections. But if you look at, I mean, Somalia and Afghanistan are the cases I know best, it really is a benchmark rather than a meaningful event. It really is something that even the donor community at this point, or at the point that the last elections were in Afghanistan, at the point that we are in Somalia, where we're gearing up for more elections, it is a very thin facade for political competition and for extracting rents. You know, these Western interventions have backed really elite exclusionary political settlements in the form of these governments. In Mali, this is true as well. And elections are a chance to like contest all of this, right? By these like really fractured exclusionary political coalitions. And that's what they are. They aren't about delivering change for people. The fraud is widespread. It's a different game. It's not elections as we know them, as I would go to vote in the US, although US elections aren't in great shape either. But like a different game, right? It's a completely different game, and we have to understand it as like something else. And that rhetoric of democracy, it can be incredibly damaging when it doesn't live up to the hype. And I saw this in Afghanistan as well. Like, people in those first elections went to the polls, were excited about this new thing, and it was going to deliver a completely different world for them, a completely different set of opportunities, a different kind of accountability to the people who had power and money than they had seen over the past, you know, the preceding 30 years of civil war. And bit by bit, every single election was more violent, more corrupt, less transparent. You saw more useless, more corrupt people elevated and rewarded through these processes. And what was it really for at the end of the day? And I think, you know, now we do work in Afghanistan, and donors still try and talk about inclusive government to them, about representation, participation. They come back and they say, really? And they point to kind of the fraud and the lack of accountability that people saw in elections in Afghanistan for 20 years. And they say, look, what is the point? And I think a lot of Afghans actually feel the same way. And they're kind of justified, because elections at home are very different than the kinds of elections in democracy that we've tried to deliver somehow in these places as a benchmark of our own progress, really, you know, and that's not the way democracy works. You know, that's not actually how you generate participation and rights-based kind of governance. It's the opposite.
It's quite interesting that you mentioned that there's been a decline even in mature democracies, such as, you know, in the US, for instance. It's a scary movement in the US right now, I can imagine. And even in the UK, you know, there's a lot of clamping down on rights, and you see this as well. And this doesn't provide that kind of, like, people see that from there and say, oh, if the people that claim to have this are behaving like this, you know, what moral ground do you have to? And it emboldens some of these dictators. But there's another thing. There's another danger. I wanted to see how dangerous that is. In these places, in Afghanistan, I think before the intervention in Afghanistan, the Russians used to be there. They had the Russians in there. And then you're seeing similar kind of like dynamics in Africa now, where you see these kuntas, you're seeing Russia, you're seeing even Iran, you're seeing these kuntas, you know, reaching out to this or Wagner group. How dangerous is that? What implication does that have?
Well, it depends on your perspective, right? I mean, like, I think a lot of countries, we see Central African Republic, Mali, elsewhere, embracing Russian influence and presence, I would argue to their peril, but they have their reasons and they're completely rational, right? And you kind of understand why this, what the Russians call their return to Africa, right? Because they see this as a longer trajectory of their involvement in African struggles for liberation. I mean, that's their narrative about it. And I think we fail to really appreciate why Wagner is being somehow embraced to the degree that it's being embraced or accepted. And what do these governments get out of it? Why are they turning to Wagner or these other militias or to the Russians for, you know, and turning their back kind of at least on the French or on others? Like what is that about? And I think it's symbolic of this wider breakdown of kind of, you know, the international order of having to kind of obey these rules and these norms and being preached to about like human rights or democracy when actually what the West's interventions have done is quite the opposite. So what does it matter anyway? You know, and they've empowered people who don't care about these values anyway. And most people are now in power and making decisions based on other values that are contrary to what, you know, the West says it wants. And I think it's dangerous if you're a citizen of any of these countries. It's dangerous, even if you're the government who's embraced, you know, these countries, thinking about Central African Republic, because ultimately, if you're relying on someone else for your security, for your ability to continue to stay in office as president, if they're, you know, raising their flag above Kidal or whatever, it's a whole new set of problems. It's like a different sponsor, a different ally. But it doesn't mean it's gonna, you know what I mean? I think it'll be interesting to see how all of this plays out. And you now see the French, the UN, the US, other European powers, the EU, really going through a bit of an existential crisis in this respect of kind of losing influence to Russia, which is interesting because it just reveals kind of how all of this has been a competition in many ways anyway. And it kind of has laid it bare, right? That they're losing their geostrategic and that's
yeah. I think another actor that we're not also talking about is China. So I've been in several panels or, you know, conference where the West also sees China as a very credible, even more than Russia, see as a more credible threat. In how do you see, and China's strategy in terms of has been a bit different. So you have whereas unlike the Western, where they go with all these human rights conditions, China has this policy of non-intervention, kind of like, but not necessarily, you know, you have that one belt road and all of that. And but it does seem also that the African elites also benefit from this. So what I'm seeing in my, you could correct me if I'm wrong, is more like a reflection of the Cold War era, where you have a new scramble, a new geopolitical competition. I don't know if you agree with that assessment.
Yeah, except it's messier, right? Because there are no longer two sides. There's you know, all these different sides. It's to say nothing about the role of the Gulf countries in the Horn of Africa. I mean, it's messy. It's a scramble. In the same way the Great Game in Afghanistan, Pakistan was a scramble because it was everyone. It was Russia. It was like anyone who could get a piece of that terrain was playing all sorts of games. And those games didn't always make sense. There wasn't always an internal logic. There were shifting political priorities. And I think that that's probably a more apt thing. And the scramble for Africa was almost more organized in a sense. They sat down and they drew lines on a map. This is completely kind of a free-for-all in a lot of respects. And there's not a lot of common understanding of what these different actors want, especially when we talk about secondary or smaller actors, like the Gulf actors, like Qatar, like UAE, like Saudi. Turkey. Yeah, Turkey is another one. So it's and I think that's one of the most interesting things to try and understand in African politics right now, and especially sitting kind of near Somalia, trying to understand the Horn, Ethiopia, and so on, is, and Sudan as well. You know, you have different actors backing multiple adversaries. Like, it's just, I mean, and just much to the detriment of the people, the civilians who are suffering the violence, right? That these, and the instability that these actors wreak. But there's just so much going on and so many people trying to shoot their shot, right? For lack of a better term, gain some sort of influence. And I think that that's often misunderstood. In a lot of these places, people kind of are very reductionist about Wagner, about China. But I think their motives and what they're learning and the mistakes they're making are more complex in many ways.
Do you think that, because you did mention the UN in your the UN, and we also looked at in Mali where the UN mission has been asked to, I think they've withdrawn now. And do you think that also speaks to the failure of the UN to be that overarching mediator or that in a neutral kind of? So what do you think the UN has done over the years? That has it lost that power? What is its future role in terms of?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing about the UN is that it bears this weight of expectation that it's going to kind of go against the tide and fight for the values within its charter and occupy this space. But the UN is only ever an expression of the politics of its member states, really, and the Security Council, and their prevailing priorities. And when that order, which I think it has done, is facing serious challenges, a sort of breakdown in moral authority, a lack of functionality within the Security Council in a lot of respects, then you begin to see the real fractures within this system. And the problem with these sort of UN peacekeeping missions has been, you know, we saw it in Afghanistan with the surge, we saw it in Mali. They're deeply constrained by the national governments, by the foreign interveners, whether it's the French or the US or Wagner Group, indeed, in those countries. And you know, what is the UN is the question. Like, what are they? They're given these grand mandates. I mean, UN mandates used to be like one or two pages. Now they're like, you know, book chapters. They cover everything from human rights to like agro-pastoral conflicts to like mediation to countering like criminality. It's ridiculous. They do not have the tools to do all of that. And they don't have the mandate to really challenge the power structures that drive kind of these conflicts. So I think that's another reason why, you know, returning to your question about peacekeeping missions, where there's no peace to keep, peacekeeping missions become these catch-alls. They're not equipped to do what they've set out to do. The UN is only called in to really clean up messes that it cannot clean up because it cannot influence the actors driving the messiness, for lack of a better term. And I think we're only now just seeing that, you know, backing away from that model of peacekeeping missions. I don't know what comes next because I don't know what the alternative is. But I think we expect much more of the UN than it was ever designed to deliver. I mean, the UN was ultimately meant to, what is it, eliminate the scourge of war. But if we look at these peacekeeping missions and the way they're kind of held hostage to geopolitical interests, Security Council, there's no way they can do or they have been able to do what we've asked them to. Even simple things like protecting civilians. How could they possibly? They can't. Not in many instances anyway.
But we've seen also like the AU itself, regional governments trying to rise to the occasion. We've seen, for instance, in the Sahel where you had the ECOWAS with a red line and not being able to do. And then also the ECOWAS. How do you see all these regional governments? Like, they, what are the prospects and what are the constraints that they face in dealing with these issues as well?
Well, they face their own internal politics, just like the UN. Just like, I mean, everything you just said about the UN applies. But what's so interesting in Africa about these regional organizations, ECOWAS, AU, you got like, and there's so many of them, is that you do have African states, and I know East Africa, the best in this respect, really asserting like, these are our problems, we can solve them, we should be in charge of solving them, right? And taking more of a leadership role. They can't always assert that, or obviously there are political conflicts. Everything is political when it's your neighborhood, right? In a certain way. But as we've seen in Ethiopia, right? And in Somalia recently, although that's been more of a mixed picture, it's interesting to see them step up in different ways and then also step away in different ways where, you know, they don't want to take that role. They don't want to get involved in somebody else's mess. They don't want to be, you know, obviously Kenyan troops don't want to be in Somalia forever, right? But it's their backyard. So like, how are they going to deal with this? As you see EU interest, as you see US interest waning in Somalia, I mean, that's one of the things that I think will be most interesting to watch. But I don't, like that's a subject of an entirely different podcast that you should do on these regional.
I can imagine.
A lot of time, actually. But it is.
I can imagine.
The evolution of them has been really, really interesting.
Let's even come back to the Horn and the East. You know, there's been a lot of black tension to the Sahel. But the Horn and the East as well, like, you know, maybe that's gone to the background a bit, but we see in Ethiopia, for instance, we have the Tigray War that just, you know, they had that peace agreement recently. But also we see in Somalia, in Congo, in other places as well. What is the situation there in those places? And how those, like, for instance, AMISOM, like Riley mentioned this, you know, has, and then the missions in Congo. I was speaking to one of my students, the master student, one of my master students that works in with the UN in Central African Republic, and he said they're just kind of like sandwiched in the capital, so they're under the capital, no control outside of that, you know, of that, and like Riley said, they have Wagner, you know, just protecting the civilians. What is the state there compared to the Sahel?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough one, right? Because it's such a, you're talking about a huge expanse. I mean, Europe could fit into just this, like, it's hard to make huge generalizations like this. But I think, you know, speaking about kind of the Horn and Somalia, Sudan, Ethiopia, I mean, you have really complex politics, and you have the UN severely challenged in all of these places, and these kinds of interventions have not worked. Sudan, according to all accounts, will be a very long war. There's no end in sight. There's no clear victor. There's no path forward. There's a real exhaustion of trying to figure out what to do about the problem of Sudan, I think, in policy circles. You obviously had a mission in Darfur, UNAMID, which left. And now look at Darfur. I mean, it's absolutely horrific. And then, of course, next door you have Somalia, which, you know, Al-Shabaab is a problem that will not go away without a different kind of political settlement. But nobody's willing to have that conversation, right? Nobody's talking about how do you change the structure of Somalia to actually make it durable, make or reduce violence in a more sustainable way. And Al-Shabaab is just one of many problems. You've had clashes in Somaliland, Puntland. You've had all of these kinds of fractures at the margins and at the center of the kind of political bargain which created the Somali government, which is basically a post 9/11 war on terror government. It was created kind of externally and is supported by this, what is now in AMISOM, this UN mission, and significant donor funding. It's really propped up by donor funding. And here's where I think the comparisons with Afghanistan are probably the strongest, although there are many differences, obviously. But you have this capital, Mogadishu, and you've had a recent offensive where the federal government has seized a lot of areas from Al-Shabaab. But I mean, how long can they hold them? It's just like a game of whack-a-mole. Until you have a different political settlement, then the Western interveners are willing to talk about, this is what will go on forever and ever. And I think That's a very different set of problems than you see in Central African Republic and Democratic Republic of Congo, especially Eastern Congo. Those are much more complex. Those are, in a way, bigger countries with completely different conflict dynamics as well.
Do you think there's a strategic interest in these policies? Because some of my research that I've looked at how do you balance let's say donors or balance Western interveners' strategic interests with this kind of like political solutions or whatever, because we can't be blind to the strategic interests behind us. So the quest for stabilizations, and for instance, we're looking at Germany in the Sahel, concerned with migration issues in the EU and all of those stuff, which I think, to be honest, to some extent is credible. It's a credible threat. But how can you balance that? What does the West needs to do? Can they say, yes, we have this interest, but in as much as we have this interest as well, we can, is there a way you can, balance these conflicting interests? Or there's no.
But what, like, this is my question often is like, what is the interest? Like, what is the EU's interest in Somalia? Is it migration? Because that's pretty simplistic, and there are cheaper solutions, right? So what, and I think these countries, it has gone on so long. They're not really sure. Like, really, if you ask them, like, what is the interest? And you poke at their rationale. I think it's pretty thin. And I remember being in Brussels last year at this kind of conference on stabilization. And, it was strange because we're talking about Mali a lot. And these EU representatives are like, why are we there? And it was sort of like, well, that's my question. Like, why actually are you there? And then a lot of these interventions, the idea of success, like, what is success in a place like Mali? Like, even in Afghanistan, what would have success? What was that, right? Like, what was the vision of these interventions? And I guess there's two answers to that. I mean, one is profoundly unrealistic, like this idea of democratic elections. Everyone has a very idealized version of like human rights, whatever. But even that it was never clearly articulated what the end state of this was and what the interests at stake really were, because I think they all grew out of this sort of 9/11 counterterror logic that didn't really, it talked about threats, but it didn't talk about, it was kind of a negative definition, right? You're combating threats. What are you creating? And I feel like we don't really know still. And I really question that. Like, what is the interest? And talking to US foreign policy officials about these places, the interest is to keep them off the president's desk, to keep them away from the headlines, to not have to deal with them at this point, because they are this like unending nightmare. Because how do you get out of here? How do you leave? Unless you're kicked out, or unless you do a deal with the Taliban, which obviously hasn't been a success in any way.
It does seem like it's an unending. Go on, go on.
No, go ahead, go ahead.
Yeah, it does seem like it's an unending cycle and a web of, you don't know how do you're just in this web of issues that it's hard to disentangle from. But if we look at it's a big question that I often just ask everyone, and how do we obtain peace, sustainable peace? What is the solution? If you become a psychic and say, how do we get sustainable peace? How do we, what will it look like? Even from an idealistic, perspective, how does that look like? It's like, imagine that.
Yeah. I mean, from the perspective of these interventions, it's about better politics and less military force, right? Because that hasn't led us anywhere good. It's about the primacy of politics and diplomacy and treating the politics seriously. And that means being a little bit more humble. I mean, you can't go into these countries and set up a government and expect it to work. unless you're going to be there forever, I think. Mm-hmm. So what does engaging with these countries on their own terms actually mean? And I don't think we know, because we've been there so long meddling in what governance looks like. But I think a second thing is, and I think about this a lot, because I do a lot of our work at the center looks at kind of how do everyday people negotiate with armed groups, and like, what is life actually like in the presence of armed groups? And what do just normal people, whatever that means, different groups of people, what are their tactics? And like, what are their expectations? Like, what are they trying to get? What would be peace to them? Like, what would be an improvement? And I think for a lot of them, it would be predictability. It would be kind of less abusive policies, more negotiating power with whoever's kind of running their lives. They want jihadist groups to stop blockading them, you know. They want to be able to negotiate. And you've seen this in Mali as well. You've seen people negotiate deals with the jihadist groups, and you see this everywhere. You see people negotiating deals because that's their way of getting whatever security they can.
Yeah.
And we just released this paper at the center by one of our fellows, Natasha Rupasinghe, and it's called like Resist, Negotiate, and Submit. And those are kind of the three strategies she saw civilians pursuing in central Mali. And what I think is interesting is how much her analysis didn't really feature the UN, didn't really feature these external interveners. People were still very much on their own. And that was true in Afghanistan when I looked at this. And it is true in a lot of cases. People are negotiating whatever peace they can. There's no like external intervener coming in to save them. You're lucky if the UN lets you into their base when you're in trouble, right? This is just the reality for people. And I think if we looked more at that, about how people are actually trying to survive or trying to get what they need to get, and based our policies on that, they would be far more effective, right, than setting up stable governance and elections every 4 years, or setting up a new political settlement, or eliminating terrorism. You're just not going to do any of those things, but you could potentially help those people better navigate those situations with better kinds of aid, more politically thoughtful engagements, all sorts of things, better setups of the UN missions. Like, what does it really mean to protect civilians? Like, what do they want? Do they want you to stay away potentially? How could this, like, I think the answer lies in actually taking these governments seriously, but also taking people seriously. What do they actually want, rather than what do we think they want, or what do we think they should have? The answers are really comfortable, I think, when we do that, because it's like they don't necessarily what we want them to want. it might be that living under jihadist groups or living under al-Shabaab is much more preferable to some people, and that's pretty incredible.
It's surprising that you say that. Like, I'm currently editing an issue on Boko Haram, and I was saying, we're thinking about rethinking Boko Haram. And I was saying, one of the arguments I've made, like, could Boko Haram not go on the path they went?
Yeah.
For instance, they want hijra, they want to practice whatever they want to practice. Could you look at it and say, within the context of religious freedom, and look at it and see how you're able to, someone wants to practice anyway, be able not to fuel it, not to create the incentive for them to just go the path of violence, you know, without, can you let them practice whatever they want to practice, do whatever they want to do within the confines of, you know? And it's surprising that you would say that. Do people want to live under a certain kind of political label or whatever? How does that really, really take away, you know, rather than imposing some kind of ideal notion of what right should be? It's quite interesting submission. But if I look at broadly where in Afghanistan, what is happening in Afghanistan now? That is your what's happening with the Taliban stuff?
Yeah.
What is
Well, first I want to say, so I was doing a beginning of year clean out of all my notes, and I was, I had printed out this article, which was from November 2001, New York Times article, which the headline was Donald Rumsfeld denies Mullah Omar's request for amnesty. And you just think how different things could have been if they let the Taliban surrender, if they took a political track and they kind of integrated the Taliban into some sort of settlement in Afghanistan. And I think that's, I really want to read this book that you're writing about Boko Haram, because it's an interesting question that, what if?
Oh, did he say Donald, what did he call his name, Donald Wu?
Donald Rumsfeld. The secretary of, and he you know, he was U.S. Secretary of Defense. He was bent on a military intervention to kind of, you know, get revenge on Afghanistan, on the Taliban for 9/11, right? That was part of the logic, right? The U.S. had to be really muscular. But what if, like, what if they had negotiated instead? And I'm not saying things would have turned out as well, but what you have, what you have is the Taliban back in power now, you know, for 2.5 years. And what if we would have negotiated sooner? Would it have been more moderate? Would they have, could you have had a power sharing deal? Like, could you have had a more pluralistic society? Like, we'll never know. And there are many people who argue, no, the Taliban was always going to be a hard line. But what we see now with Afghanistan, and I've been back since they've taken over, and we do a lot of work there as the center, is that it's a really complicated picture. You have edicts that recently the Vice and Virtue Police, I think this past week, they've started cracking down on what they call improper hijabs. So women who aren't conservatively dressed enough. And you see these trends of, from the beginning of this kind of Taliban takeover, them getting more and more and more and more conservative. But there are so many Taliban who profoundly disagree with that. The Taliban is an incredibly diverse movement and now an incredibly diverse government. I mean, they banned girls' education, but there are girls' schools in a lot of places, right? The girls, Taliban are still sending their girls to school. So it's this really complicated picture of repression and restriction, we would say the old Taliban is. And then this other side of the story, which is Afghanistan has changed immensely in the past, you know, 20, 25 years. And the Taliban have also changed a bit. So it's not an easy story to tell, because you don't want to diminish the human rights abuses and the repression, but then there's also a lot of gray areas. And one of my friends is a woman who used to be under the Republic, she was a minister of education, and she's from the south, and her father was killed by the Taliban, he's a long time ago, but she still goes back, she still runs a business in Afghanistan. She still engages, and she is, I think, one of the most more powerful and more coherent than I am, speaking about these complexities of saying we have to engage, we have to talk to these people. Like, there really is no other way forward than to deal with this reality and to try and engage with reality. I mean, my fear is that it just keeps worsening and worsening, and we're on this path which will ultimately lead to another conflict, because Afghans won't live like this, right? They want their girls to go to school. They want a certain life, which the Taliban seems to be hell-bent on denying them. But we'll see.
Good. Well, it's been an interesting conversation, Ashley, and I know you're very busy. I really appreciate.
I'm so glad we had a chance to sit down and talk.
It's been an interesting conversation. I really enjoyed your deep insights into Western intervention, and
well,
thank you very, very much, Ashley. It's been a pleasure of mine to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, listeners. We're very grateful to have Dr. Ashley Jackson, and we're thankful for his for her deep insight into Western interventions in the last 20 years. Thank you very much, and stay tuned for our next episode.